Hello and welcome to History's Nightfall podcast. My name's Dan Jones, and I'm a historian, broadcaster, and frustrated Knight Templar, born just 7 centuries out of time, but doing my best to make up for it through the medium of podcasting. Since this is the final episode of the podcast, we've got more spoilers than you can shake a holy grail at, so please don't listen unless you've already finished the first season of Nightfall. Or, I suppose, if you're just finding the tension too much to bear. Now, the first season of Nightfall has taken our characters a long way, but where might they be going next? In this episode, I'll be talking to a few members of the cast of Nightfall about the amazing season finale, the journey their characters have been on, and what they would most love to see happen in the dark and dangerous world of Nightfall in the future. But first, let's recap on that season-closing episode of Nightfall. So it's episode 10, aka The Big One, and it gets going with a bang. Specifically, the bang Landry took to his knee last time, when Gawain decided to give him a taste of what it feels like to be a one-legged warrior and caved his leg in with a hammer that looked like he'd borrowed it from Thor. Landry's first reaction, obviously, is to let out a good old-fashioned hashtag Landry roar. But just as importantly, knee clubbing is a chance for Draper to show off some more of his repertoire of medical skills.
I don't think so.
If you remember, a few episodes back, Draper helped cure Rashid's son, and actually Rashid himself, of some pretty nasty sword wounds by jabbing them with a red-hot poker. But for Landry, he has something a bit more sophisticated in store. No, not an ice bath, not a splint, not even a couple of naproxen and a lie down.
Is his knee broken?
Actually, he's going to sort him out by jabbing a sharp metal spiky thing into his leg to bleed the pain out.
But we need to ease the swelling.
As they say in the WWE, don't try and recreate any of these moves at home. Now, while Landry's having his knee drained, big things are going on with the Grail. Last time we saw it, Altani was stuffing it in her pocket and abseiling out of a window. And now she's taken it down the path, where Dinogore is only too happy to meet her and receive it.
As promised.
If it were me, I'd have asked the barman to put half a pint of IPA in there just to see what happens. But Dinogore has bigger things on his mind. He takes it to the palace and gives it to King Philip.
My God, Dinogore. You found it.
Speaking of Philip, last time we saw him, he was trying to process the fact that Landry was the father of Joan's unborn child. And to be fair to him, he's trying everything. Last episode, that meant beating Joan's maid half to death. This time, he's going with the whole beg and plead approach.
Philip and Joan can pretend.
Yes, Philip and Joan could pretend, I guess. Or, alternatively, Philip could lure Joan's boyfriend into a battle on the pretext of recovering the Grail for the Pope before murdering one or the other, or both of them.
First, you will see your lover buried. Second, you will call for him as you give birth to his child. And finally, you will watch as I cut out that child's bastard heart.
Actually, when you put it like that, it does seem a bit more straightforward than letting bygones be bygones. Fortunately, Joan has one last play. She belts Philip over the head with a candlestick,
quickly,
tells everyone he's fainted, jumps on a horse and rides out to meet Landry with a grail tucked up her skirt.
It's the Queen.
Whatever else you think of her, this lady doesn't give up. Now, while all that was going on in the palace, Landry has failed to convince de Molay to gather all the Templars in France together to get the grail back for the Pope.
I formally request the mobilisation of the entire French Temple.
The entire French Temple?
That's a definite no there from de Molay. But no matter. Landry gathers up the men he has and sets off from Paris.
Sure, we ride a lot.
Joan catches up with him in the forest of Versailles.
Philip knows.
Warns him that Dinogore's red knights are coming.
They're going to kill you.
And tips him off that she has the grail.
I have the grail.
But she's too late. Just as she's tucking the grail back inside her skirt, the ambush arrives.
Brothers!
You know that big battle we've been waiting for all season?
Prepare to fight!
It's on. Now, one man who's been quiet for a while is Gawain, and we find out why, because he's the one leading the Red Knights. It turns out that just as Dinogore promised, the French royal doctors are rather better than the Templar doctors. I mean, no offence, Draper.
And all I needed?
And they fixed his leg up a treat.
What, the King's doctor?
He leads the Red Knights into battle. All of which is so exciting that Joan's waters break. The good news, the baby's coming.
The baby is coming.
The bad news, Draper's going to be the midwife.
Do you know how to do this?
I promise you, I will see the child safely into this world.
Chill out, Your Grace. All it takes is a red-hot poker and a spiky thing. Don't worry about it. Back in the battle, things are going better than you'd have thought for the Templars. Until, that is, Gawain lures Landry into a ring of red knights who drag him into a clearing and present him to King Philip, who's put on his best armour for the occasion. So which Philip are we going to see? Philip and Joan Philip? Or I'm going to kill everyone in sight Philip? Silly question, really. In a fight weirdly reminiscent of that bit at the end of Gladiator when Russell Crowe gets wailed on by a manifestly inferior Emperor Whackin' Phoenix because he's been slyly stabbed in the back before the fight starts, Landry ends up taking a right royal beating. Then, what's this? Oh, jeez, it's Joan. Joan, don't do it. Seriously, it's too late. The Queen busts into the circle, pleads for Landry's life,
I am to blame
and gets stabbed through the heart for her trouble.
No.
Unfair? It certainly feels unfair. But listen, that Philip and Joan option does look increasingly attractive in retrospect, doesn't it? Anyway, pretty soon after that, all the fighting is over because along comes de Molay with Templar reinforcements. The King and the Red Knights all scarper, leaving Joan and Landry to say their tragic farewells. And genuinely, it's a tearjerker, particularly when Joan tells Landry about the little shepherd's shack in the poppy fields of Pamplona she'd spotted as a fixer-upper for the pair of them.
If I were to ask you now to come with me to Navarre, what would you do?
I would come with you.
Of course he would. And maybe he just will, because don't forget that Joan came to this battle with the Holy Grail.
The Grail.
And if there's one thing the Grail's supposed to do, it's fixing up people who've been stabbed through the heart by their vengeful husbands, right?
By heavens, it's working.
Or is it?
Do you see the blue? And the horses?
Should he use the spiky thing and the red hot poker, I guess?
Joan.
So Joan dies, Joan. And Landry smashes the Grail to pieces on a tree in a rage. It's all over. He's lost everything. Oh, wait a minute. No, he hasn't. Once more, the spiky thing triumphs as Draper performs a post-mortem caesarean in the middle of a forest and hands Landry the one thing that might just offer him some redemption in the midst of all this misery. A little baby girl.
It's a girl. It's a miracle.
And so we come to the end of this first season. Joan's dead, Gawain's gone rogue, the Grail smashed to bits, the Brotherhood of Light is all messed up, Landry's leaving the temple with a baby and an ongoing obsession with poppies and horses, and most importantly of all, Tancred is auditioning to be the new Pope.
Laudate Dominum.
Will he do it? What was that little bit of parchment that the shady Templar found in the base of the Grail? And how exactly is Landry going to suckle a newborn with all that chainmail on him? There are as many questions as answers here, aren't there? So let's get on with the show. Okay, so the first thing I wanted to talk about in this podcast was a group of characters whom we don't get to know individually, but have a big impact on the events of the final episode of this season. They're called the Red Knights, the de Nogaret's mercenary army, which he was angling to put together for most of the season. They're well-trained, and they're clearly unscrupulous, as de Nogaret told Philip in episode 9.
You're sure these men can take on the Templars?
They have one advantage. They fight dirty.
So, historically, who are the Red Knights? Well, as usual with Nightfall, what I think we can see in the Red Knights is a blending together of history with legend. Now, in early drafts of the script for this episode, they were actually named, I think, as Teutonic Knights, that is, members of another real-life military order which had been set up in the Holy Land around 1190, at the time of the Third Crusade, but who by this time, that's the beginning of the 14th century, had their base in and around Prussia and the Baltic, where they'd been, quote-unquote, crusading against pagans. As this episode went through the usual rewrites and drafts, however, they changed from Teutonic Knights to Blood Knights, and then finally to Red Knights. Now, for me, that's quite a nice solution because historically, I remember thinking it was probably a bit too extreme to have Templars facing off on the battlefield in Europe against Teutonic Knights. But more than that, the name Red Knight has centuries-old connections to the very first Grail legends written in the 12th century. In Chrétien de Troyes' Perceval, a story of King Arthur's court, where the Grail is a recurring motif, the hero, Perceval, has a defining showdown with a single Red Knight, who steals from the king and is later killed by Perceval himself, who takes his armour and becomes known as the Red Knight. Now, all the major Arthurian writers who followed Chrétien de Troyes, and I'm talking here about Wolfram von Eschenbach, Robert of Boron, right up to Thomas Malory, well, they continued to build on the tale of the Red Knight, giving him a father, brothers, and a whole developed backstory. And then, of course, you have other colour-coded knights added into this Arthurian mythology. Most famously, I think, in the story by the so-called Pearl Poet, who wrote Gawain and the Green Knight in the 14th century. So by having Red Knights in Nightfall, I think, or at least I'm guessing, the writers are giving a little wink to the Arthurian origins of our story. But there's one more thing to say here too, because of course Red Knights plural are clearly not the same as the Red Knight singular from medieval romance and legend. As we've said, in Nightfall they're a mercenary army. But that, I think, is also a good example of Nightfall rolling in other aspects of the medieval world to its storytelling. Because later in the 14th century, during the Hundred Years' War, France, and actually Italy as well, would be absolutely plagued by mercenary soldiers, also known as routiers. They went about in companies identified by either a symbol or a colour, and they really were swords for hire, who would serve anyone who could afford them, backstab and betray anyone who didn't pay them enough, and caused a major breakdown in public order. And if you want to know more about them, then I suggest you look into the history of perhaps the most notorious mercenary of them all, the Englishman John Hawkwood, who led a gang of routiers in the later 14th century. They were called the White Company, which isn't exactly the Red Knights, and actually today, the White Company is the name of a shop in England that sells upmarket bed linen. But I think this similarity is striking enough, and it shows once again just how many historical and mythological references are lurking in Nightfall when you scratch the surface. Now, very shortly, we'll be speaking to Simon Merrills, Ed Stoppard and Olivia Ross. But first up, we've got Porrig Delaney, who plays Gawain, to talk about the big set-piece battle in this episode between the Templars and the Red Knights. If you think back to the very first episode of this podcast, you'll remember that we talked then about the fact that the entire set of Nightfall, based out in Prague in the Czech Republic, burned down during production. As we said then, this had ramifications further down the line, with the final episodes being filmed much later than originally planned. So that epic battle ended up being shot in the dead of a Czech winter, and that meant two things, snow and mud. I asked Porrig Delaney what it was like to film that battle.
When people ask me my overriding of Nightfall, it's of weather extremes, because we started in Dubrovnik, obviously, in the old city, when the siege of Acre, and running around in our chainmail, Simon falling into the pier, that was 38 degrees Celsius on that day, I remember. And of course, it was hot in Prague, you know, when we made the move over here. But then, yeah, fast forward 7 months later, middle of December, in Pruhonice Park, filming that big battle sequence that you mentioned, and one day it was minus 15.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty cold. It was pretty cold for the first few days, and then the weather changed again, and it got a little bit milder. And then it rained, so the place just became this big mud bath after a while. I think in total we were out there for about 2 weeks filming all of these action sequences. It was pretty miserable at times, you know, to be honest. But, you know, I just kept reminding myself how lucky I was, and we all were, to be on, you know, a job like this. Because it is kind of, this job is a dream come true. So yeah, it was tough. We ended up wearing football boots, because it became so muddy underneath. Because you had the frost eventually and the ground was so hard. And then the rain on top of that, and we chopped everything up so much, running around and battling. I think we had like 300 extras and actors and stunt people. That we were, everyone was losing their grip, and it just became comical at one stage. So we all got commissioned these Templar boots, but they were football boots, and the Templar boot had been built around it. So again, costume did an amazing job. So all of the Templars looked heroic and strong on their 2 feet, but unfortunately a lot of the extras kept slipping and sliding around. And of course that affects you on the day and informs what you do on the day and informs your character. And it just makes you go, my God. I mean, not only medieval warfare, but you can imagine in the trenches in World Wars I and II, and just how horrific that must have been, and how bloody lucky we are today. So I think there were lots of moments where we were feeling sorry for ourselves. But I think, you know, I would often, the way I put it is, you want to do justice to the memories of people like that, you know, who gave their lives so that we can have the luxury of making TV series like this for our entertainment. You know, it's a tiny sacrifice, and I feel embarrassed saying that, but I always think that when I'm on, especially on a historical job, that I've got a responsibility, like a duty of care to kind of look after what they did. And you know, I think there is a big responsibility for actors in that way, to make it real, make it count. Don't shirk from your duties. It's when you consider what young men and women have gone through down through the centuries in the name of freedom.
So did anyone spot the studs on the soles of the Knights' customised football boots? If you did, then tweet us a picture using the hashtag Knightfall. Now, what with Simon Merrill's long list of near misses during the production of Knightfall, I'm surprised he made it to the end of the first season, never mind his character Tancred. So what does he think the future holds for his character?
Well, it's funny because you send your mind out as a kind of forward dog to see what's going to happen. You send your brain out, you know, across the fields into the futures, imagining what would happen. And, you know, we're left at the end of the first season with the beginning of devastation. You know, Landry comes clean about his affair with the Queen, and the King and he are now blood enemies. That can't be gone back on, I wouldn't think. And I wouldn't think, if we are being truthful, that he can stay master or indeed a Templar. There are many options, and there were many options when the manure finally hit the medieval fan.
Mm. A windmill, but, I think.
Yeah, a windmill.
The manure hit the windmill, yeah.
Yes, sorry. A child's windmill, a small windmill. But it's very exciting because I think perhaps... I feel strange saying it because I don't know. I'm going to visit the writer's room myself and introduce myself and say, hi, guys. You're writing for me, and I'm so happy to be, you know, an action man in your toy box. But potentially Tancred could take over as master.
Tancred could become acting master. That would be amazing.
He could. Well, he could become master.
That would be something.
I mean, historically... Jacques de Molay was the Grand Master, of course, but we're talking about the Paris Temple. These are all possibilities, so I'm just positing it. Gawain, of course, has completely gone over to the dark side. Mm. However, one of the most powerful themes in drama is redemption, so who knows? There might be somewhere down the line for redemption of his character, or maybe he becomes Philip's attack dog, de Nogaret's attack dog, and seeks out Landry. I think Tancred would have to be, you know, very foremost in securing Landry's escape or protecting him or hiding him. There's no reason why all of the Templar Order need to become enemies of the King because we could posit that, you know, Land, none of us knew about his betrayal. He's been expelled from the order. So there are many possibilities for the story. And of course, Templar history, it sweeps over the whole of Christendom and moves towards the east. So he could be in Cyprus. He could be in England. There were many friends to the Templars in England who later on didn't believe any of the charges of Philip. And they only gave way reluctantly in the end to arresting them. So, you know, real history is rich with possibility and event. And then alongside that, we have our wonderful writers writing our fantasy within the middle of that. So, you know, the sky's the limit, really.
Now, as Simon was suggesting, there are some exciting possibilities when it comes to the next steps in the history of the Knights Templar. We've seen a big change in King Philip IV over this season, from Landry's best mate to mortal enemy, from peace lover to warmonger, from doting husband to, well, the exact opposite. So I asked Ed Stoppard, who plays Philip, what his favourite part of that journey was.
I quite like the sword fighting. Which I think all my sword fighting was with Tom Cullen. And it's just always nice. It's always nice being within 10 feet of Tom Cullen because he's just a really nice bloke. Yeah. But I like the sword fighting. I guess I like the last episode 9, episode 10, where Philip becomes kind of more proactive. He's kind of at the mercy of the current, I felt, to an extent, through the first part of the series. It feels like sort of things are being acted upon him. And then somewhere around episode 8, he kind of, you know, he has a bit of a kind of Damascene moment and the scales fall from his eyes and he just starts to take charge of his own destiny a bit more. And actually, that was kind of nice because you always like, you know, as an actor, you like kind of playing strong motivations and that kind of thing.
And what are Ed's hopes for playing the character in the future?
In no particular order, England, Pope, money, Templars, wardrobe.
This is like his shopping list. It's like my to-do list.
And I said in no particular order, but if it was up to me, wardrobe would go to the top of that list. Because, you know, we didn't have, you know, an enormous amount of fun on this show. We didn't laugh very much. But one of the things that did make me kind of laugh and grimace at the same time was the number of dresses that Olivia Ross had as Queen Joan. I'm not kidding you. I think, like, I mean, there came a point where I was kind of going, is that a new dress? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, how many is that now? And I think by the end of the show, she'd had, and I'm not making this up, 14, possibly 15 different costumes. And I essentially had one costume. With all due respect to our wonderful costume designer, Deanna, I think I had one costume, which would then have two or three different things put on top of it. And bear in mind that one of those two or three things was a suit of armor. So that doesn't sort of count, really, because, you know, everyone's got one of those type of things. So, you know, yes, England, the Pope, Templars, blah, 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 but some dresses, some nicer, you know,
some dresses,
flowing costumes.
And a bodice and a corset and stuff.
I mean, look, I want to keep it. I want to keep it period. I want to keep it. Historically accurate, but
thank you.
Glad
to hear that.
That's for you. But yeah, a couple more costumes. That's all I ask, really. A couple more costumes.
Now, if you know your medieval French history, or you've been paying close attention during this podcast series, then you'll know that in real life, Queen Joan was dead at the point at which Nightfall begins. An example of the show's writers deciding to massage history into the shape they needed to serve the drama. And of course, the drama that it produced in this final episode of Nightfall was pretty intense. And it ended with Joan restored, in a grim sense, to her rightful place, which was dead and buried. Last time I spoke to Olivia Ross on this podcast, she had some fascinating observations about her character Joan as a medieval feminist icon. And I wanted to ask her how she felt about her character's death.
The point is that, for instance, you know, as I said about the love story, if you know that, like, a love story is impossible, there's nothing... I mean, I remember we talked about it all throughout the show, I think, because the lovely creative team and myself were both kind of like, no, I was like, don't kill me. And they were like, we don't want you to leave. But at the same time, it's so memorable if it's so tragic. So first there was a bit of that. There was a bit of, you know, you don't want it to become mundane. Like, it is tragic. And it's actually, again, you know, from a feminist perspective, particularly tragic. There's always, you know, the women who get the very violent, you know, brutal end of the stick in the love triangle, you know. So that, I think, is also quite, you know, challenging and but so, I mean, so important to, like, point out. But also, I think that you had to, it had to end, and you couldn't end it in a mundane way. The point is that this is also about, like, the fact that there's a battle happening at the same time, the fact that everything is, you know, reaching a summit at the same time.
Mm. Yes.
You know, so then you would have had to have her stay at home and be ill, for instance.
Yes.
Or, and we know Philip doesn't die. Philip can't really die yet because, you know, that he has such a long life. So that would be forcing history a bit too far, probably. And obviously, Landry's the leading man. So, you know, so out of the three, first of all, it probably has to be her. And then I think there is something amazing about, like, yes, she dies, but she also, like, the way she goes into that battle, for instance, I think is just amazing. And because we spoke about it quite a lot, because I think there was a lot of discussions around, you know, a really pregnant woman going on a horse and riding all the way to find her lover in the middle of the forest, and how plausible that is or not. And that's, for instance, something I did quite a bit of research on to kind of wrap my head around it. And, like, heavily, well, people in situations of challenge can do such extraordinary things. One of the guys who did the stunts, his wife, when she was pregnant, she rode until she was like 8 months pregnant, you know. And then, not to mention, in more sort of tragic context, like, you see, like, there's loads of, you know, articles about, I don't know, like, an eight and a half months pregnant woman walks for, like, 5 days to find whatever, you know, like...
the Holy Grail.
So that, yeah. So that was kind of amazing to put her in an active place in that, is what I mean.
No,
so she's not just being passively killed. She's, like, actively fighting, you know. Like, she goes in to defend her lover when he's being beaten up by the king in a very unfairly way, because obviously the king's completely hijacked him and Landry's on his own, and, you know, the he's in the middle of that circle of armed man. There's nothing he can do, and she goes in. The men let her go through, of course, because she's still their queen. So they do, you know, if it had been anyone else, they would have stopped her. They would have stopped that other person, you know, who it would be. If it was a Templar, they would have stopped them. But because it's the queen, they let her go through. And then the king fights back. But I think what's amazing is that she fights too.
While I had Olivia on the phone, I had to ask, with Landry walking off into the forest with their swaddled newborn in his arms, how is he actually going to feed the baby?
Well, but you know, at the time anyway, most of the child feeding was not done by the mother itself anyway.
But it wasn't done by a Templar. I mean, I've never heard of a Templar wet nurse.
But you would find a wet nurse. That's the point.
So season two, episode one, Landry, having found the Grail, goes in search of a wet nurse. I think they've got their work cut out for them, don't you?
He's a clever boy. I'm sure he can find something. He can sort something out.
Before we go, I just want to speak about the final teaser in Nightfall, which we see in the penultimate scene of the show, in which the shattered remains of the Holy Grail seem to contain a little scrap of parchment with a bunch of names in different types of script, ending with Landry de Lauzon. We've seen and heard on this podcast that the show repeatedly avoids ascribing magical powers to the Grail itself, but here, finally, seems to be the secret to its power. Quite literally a secret, and evidently the same thing that Anna has told the Pope. And seeing as Anna was the one who knew about it, and that it saved Landry from his excommunication in episode 9, perhaps we can speculate that it must have been some sort of secret bloodline, or a similar line of descent, with major implications for Christian doctrine or the history of the Church. So if that's what the writers intended, and I don't know this for certain, but I feel like they probably did, then they're toying with one of the greatest Templar and Grail legends in town, which has been incredibly popular in recent decades. That's the idea that the Grail is not a mysterious secret object per se, but a metaphor for some cosmic truth. Now, there have been dozens, if not hundreds, of versions of this pseudo-history, which tend to come back to the idea, in short, that Jesus had a wife who may or may not have been Mary Magdalene, that they had children, and that these children are, by virtue of their descent, special. As a side note, mainly for Brotherhood of Light fans, I suppose, there are obvious parallels here with the history of Islam and its own sectarian divides, in which the claims of Shia Islam to be the true faith rest on arguments about familial or at least tribal descent from Muhammad's early followers. Anyway, in the case of Grail mythology, the Christ's bloodline trope was most famously developed in a book written in the 1980s, 1982 it first came out, called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. The argument, which is slightly cranky, is that Jesus had children, that his descendants fled to France, that they became the Merovingian kings in the early Middle Ages, and that the identity of their own descendants, who have since ceased to be kings, is protected by a secret society called the Priory of Sion. Now, the title of the book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, as well as its argument, is actually based on a pun in Old French, that sang real, holy blood, sounds enough like san graal, holy grail, that the two things have been confused over the years and merged into one. Now, whether you take all that seriously or not is up to you. And my advice is that you view it as a bit of fun rather than something with any factual merit. But it is up to you. What's important for our purposes is that the ideas of Holy Blood, Holy Grail are similar to those that underpin Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, probably the most famous bit of Templar fake history in our times. In other words, here we have Nightfall, even as it sees off its leading lady, still tweaking us by playing with not only medieval history, but the whole meta-history of Templar and Grail obsessions. And all that brings us to a close for the final time for season one of the official Nightfall podcast. I hope you've enjoyed these extra bits from the cast and crew. I know I've absolutely loved delving into all their very generously shared stories, anecdotes, and insights from production. And I hope that this series has also given you a thirst for all things Templar and Grail legend related too. If there's anything you think we missed, anything you want to ask, then you can tweet me directly at DG Jones, and you can stay up to date with all things Nightfall related by searching for Nightfall or History on Facebook and Twitter. In the meantime, by the grace of God, thanks for listening. History's Nightfall podcast is presented by Dan Jones and produced by Sam Pearson for A&E Networks.